Unlabeled Leadership is a volunteer service. We appreciate our guests for their stewardship and remarkable stories. We also appreciate listeners like you who back the show with star reviews and contributions.
Gary DePaul with Unlabeled Leadership. Welcome to episode 144, Chapatod focuses on accurate thinking. Here's a shout out to listeners in Bucharesti, Romania, and in the United States, Wise, Virginia, Berwick, Pennsylvania, Amherst, Ohio, Sanford, North Carolina, and Potomac, Maryland. With that, let's get started. Chapa is the only person I know with a master's in Italian linguistics and a dissertation about Italian, English, and Hungarian proverbs. Chapa is a native of Hungary, and he currently resides in the UK. He has more than 15 years' experience setting up startups, working with Fortune 500 companies, government agencies, and entrepreneurs. He is the founder and owner of ICQ Global, a people development organization with more than 160 licensed partners in 42 countries. Chapa has certified more than 80 coaches, and he consults globally. He's the author of the best-selling book, Uncommon Sense in Unusual Times, which has the subtitle, Make Sense of What and How and Why People Think and Behave Differently so You Can Create Synergy Instead of Driving Each Other Crazy. I've seen Chapa present on a few occasions, and I recommend finding him, connecting with him, listening to what he has to say, because he is well-researched and much of what he talks about is evidence-based. Part 1. Our perception depends on the quantity and quality of information. When meeting someone for the first time, our brains automatically categorize whether the person is like us or not. If the person isn't like us, we tend to view the person in extreme, black and white, simplistic, whereas if we categorize the person as being like us, we tend to view them in a more nuanced and complex way. Chapa shares with us a story from his teenage years that has to do with making these types of judgments about other people. Here's Chapa with his story.
When I was 16, I started doing martial arts. I was really good at it. I used to compete. I was also a good student, which didn't make a lot of sense. So when I was in the dormitory, then I had a lot of problems because people misunderstood me. You look at me, then you expect something else. There was something that one of the teachers said, and he used to be in the military. He used to be a sergeant, I think. And he said, it's not enough to be good, but you have to look good as well. And that time I didn't really understand what he meant exactly. But then I built a whole business around this, because people can see only your behavior, not your intention. And often they judge you based on their own values, their own beliefs, all experiences. That can be a problem. The biggest distance between two people is misunderstanding. I have to realize that this is what happens between people. For example, when I think hard, then I look angry. So you can imagine when I do a workshop or coaching, the impact I had on people when they asked the question and I looked angry. That's not what you want. And I have to realize it is my responsibility. If I know that it's a weakness, it can be misunderstood, then I have to do something about it. Now, when I do a workshop, for example, I tell them in advance that if I look angry, I'm just thinking, that's a good sign. Don't misunderstand it. That was the most important lesson in high school, to be honest.
It's not just what you say, it's observations of your behaviors, and people attribute what they think is going on inside your head. When you look angry, they assume you're angry because that's how they might look or what they've experienced in the past. Just clarifying that, no, it's just how you process your thinking. The biggest distance between people is misunderstanding. I think that's a beautiful way of putting some of the struggles that we as a society and an organization, some of the challenges that we experience.
It happens because we have to understand that the brain is not wired for optimism. The brain is designed to assume the worst case scenario because that is the safest option. It's very primal. The brain is a machine to judge the situations, the future, to predict it. The safest option is when you assume your worst so you can avoid pain. You can avoid the danger. This is what we need to understand. Instead of relying on toxic positivity, if we focus on accurate thinking and we understand how our mind works, then it's much easier to optimize it. That's the goal. That's what we do.
When you said that you competed in martial arts, what is it about martial arts that people misjudged you by your appearance?
I think it was more about the reputation. So I don't think there's anything wrong with the martial arts. But when you see someone who is, let's say, 85 kilo, really short hair, you know that almost every night he goes to the training and he fights there. You wouldn't assume that that person is a really good student. And that had the same problem here in the UK as well when I moved here. So for example, in Hungary, if you pay attention to someone, then you look into their eyes. That's how you show respect. That's how you show the connection. But here, it was very different. People found it terrifying because now you can imagine that person is 35 years old, that time or 30, 90 kilo, short hair, leather jacket, looking into your eyes. And they found it really aggressive. My intention was really positive, respect. But the impact was really negative because it was perceived as a threat.
I completely get it. It happens in the US with race. A black person wears a hoodie. Like you were saying, the brain assumes the worst case. You're a white person. You're passing in the street. You may think this person is going to harm me when it's just a teenager who just wants to get on with life and has no malice in mind.
At the same time, it is also normal and kind of natural. Our perception depends on the quality and quantity of information. What do you see in, for example, in the news, the bad news? Because good news is promotion. So you hear the horrible stories. What do you see in movies? The people in the hoodies are usually not lawyers. They are not nice people. If this is the kind of information that we keep getting, if you hear something enough times, we tend to believe it. That's why we have to take responsibility for this.
It's a type of bias. When we view murder as a high rate of death, when suicide is higher, people don't get that because they watch the news. I think it's interesting that Apple computers refuse to allow movie producers to use their computers with villains. You had to be a good guy to use their Apple computers on the set because they didn't want people to perceive Apple as having this negative connotation. It's really interesting.
I didn't know that. I was just surprised how come I can see so many Surface laptops recently in movies, but I didn't know that.
Part 2, the fragility of certainty and agreeability. Leadership is about helping other people mature mentally and morally. It's about helping them build character. When leading, one of the things you try to do is build an environment in which people can be at their best. One of the common characteristics of leading is that you help other people develop their leadership capabilities. In this story, Jabba talks about a vice president who does this. Once again, here's Jabba.
We were working with the regional managers and the VP of a pharmaceutical company. We had a one-year program. The VP was pretty much equally feared and respected. He wasn't the most pleasant person, definitely. And I wasn't a big fan of him in the very beginning. I knew that he was really smart, but at a personal level, I don't think he was outstanding. Until we had a workshop together and I saw how he interacted with the regional managers. So there was a case study where they had to plan something. And the whole point was that the regional managers had to come up with a plan in case something happens to the VP. The questions that he asked was so inspiring. Those questions generated the kind of insights that those people never thought about. They realized that he's not a bad person. Maybe his style is questionable, but his intention was really good. If you are a real leader, then you are creating leaders, not followers. Often the bad leaders want to stand out by pushing other ones down, make them dependent on them. But he created other leaders. To me, that was a turning point. And I thought, wow, that's pretty amazing. People can see your behavior. They don't know why you do what you do. Often people have common sense, they have good intention, but somehow it backfires because people misunderstand it.
It's refreshing when someone is bringing questions and bringing perspective that encourages other people and enabling other people to lead in their own capacity versus traditional leadership, where it's more about following orders, command and control and getting people to achieve certain goals, but doing it the way that you might think it's the best way of doing it. But if you enable people to lead, then you're giving them the opportunity to be creative, innovative. It actually makes it easier for you when that happens.
This is the paradox of leadership, especially when we talk about the only layer of diversity that has proven benefit in terms of performance, which is cognitive diversity. Then it's a very difficult topic because when somebody disagrees with us, it doesn't feel good, no matter what. That's exactly where the potential lies for success or disaster. The problem with these dominant leaders is that under pressure, the people, the followers, the employees give away their power. They have only one perspective, exactly what they need the most. You lose the power of diversity. But if you choose to become a leader who leads with prestige, not dominance, then you can harness the power of cognitive diversity. If you can see the same situation from different perspectives, then you can make better decisions. That would be the goal. But insecure leaders need to control others. That is the most dangerous thing. I think it was President Obama said, at times of crisis, people hang on to guns and religion. People need certainty. The real question is, where do you get yours from? Is it coming from the outside, like a strong leader, a confident one? Is it a political party? Is it a national identity? Is it a way of eating? Is it a religion? Is it something else? If it's not coming from inside, then that's a really dangerous place because it's fragile. That's what we have to work on. Trust yourself, know who you are, and then you can tap into the power of cognitive diversity because you are willing and able to share your opinion, your insights, your ideas. Ultimately, that makes the situation better and safer. Not when we are hiding, not when we are trying to stay in the comfort zone. That feels good, but let's be honest, the world is changing. Everything is changing around us. Pretending that it's not is not sustainable. The gap is getting bigger between us and the world. Slowly we are getting to a breaking point where you sink or swim. Would it make more sense to walk today so you don't have to run tomorrow? But that kind of goes against nature. Telling people to get out of the comfort zone is almost like, just go against nature. No, your brain doesn't want that. Your brain wants to keep you there. Your brain wants you to hang out with people who agree with you, not disagree with you, because that's dangerous. This is something that we need to work on intentionally, because that is the safest option. There is no certainty in life. Yes, of course, a few things are certain, but their timings can be unpleasant. But in general, there is no certainty. So we should have that inside.
For people who begin to accept the concept that there is no certainty, although it's very comforting when you have it, obviously. If you get to that point, does your thinking change? Does the way your brain processes information change when you're able to accept uncertainty more than you were younger?
People do their best based on what they know. You know, that's why we shouldn't criticize people, because maybe that's the only way they know to express their values and meet their needs. Instead of suppressing those, let's show them a better way of doing things. And yes, when I was younger, then I thought I was doing the right thing. That's exactly why I started my company, because I realized that, you know what, if you make a mistake and you hurt yourself, you get over it. It doesn't matter. But if you hurt people around you for years, believing that you're doing the right thing for all of them, and then you have to realize that you were hurting them, that is horrible. To me, that is the personal reason why I'm doing this. The corporate side is the added bonus. That's fantastic. But this is the personal reason. What if you're doing the right thing? What if you think that you are heading towards the right direction because it feels good, but it's not the right one? That is painful. And I did that. And that's why now I would rather want to get things right instead of being right. If somebody is insecure, not confident enough, then they have to be right. The ego wants to be seen good. They don't want to be good. Real safety comes from the fact that we can be more, so we can do more. If something is too rigid, it breaks. Once we can reframe this and we realize that an activity can be uncomfortable, then, you know, naturally the brain would register it as, ooh, pain, avoid it. But we realize that even if it's uncomfortable, it's still positive, then I'm willing to do it because I know how it serves me and the people around me. But if that is not clear and we just react instead of responding, then we are going to avoid those activities. We stay in the comfort zone, and then we are going to hang out with people like us.
Part 3, leveling up, and self-inclusion. There's a lot that we can do to build our leadership capabilities. Some of the changes can be simple behavior adjustments, while others are more about changing the way we think and view what we do. Java advises two ways that we can strengthen our leadership. Here's Java.
In that case, I would have two pieces of advice. The first one is something that I heard from one of my colleagues. He said, you should practice some purposeful doubt. I said, what is purposeful doubt? What are you talking about? It means that you don't question yourself. You don't have doubts in yourself, because be confident, find out who you are, what you stand for, and be okay with it. Accept it. But on a regular basis, double check your best practices, your habits. Are they still serving you, or they might be hurting you? Just ask the right question. Is there an even better way of doing things? The reason why I really like this approach is because often coaches and consultants and trainers are really passionate about change and transformation. But what the clients hear is that, oh no, so I'm not good enough. And I'm paying you to tell me that I'm not good enough. And it's going to be painful. No, thank you. But when you talk about leveling up, that implies that you are already awesome, but you can be even better. Having purposeful doubt is exactly about that. Let's find out if there's an even better way of doing things. If there's an argument or disagreement with someone, then it's obvious that if I know I'm right, the other person is wrong. But instead of finding out who is right or wrong, why don't we ask a different question? Is there an even better way of doing things? Because if that's what you ask, nobody can lose. You can only win. If it's your version, great. If it's theirs, fantastic. If it's a combination, so good. Nobody lost. That would be important. The second one is, I think originally that is from Sadhguru, the Indian guru who created the Inner Engineering program. He was talking about being blissfully dissatisfied, which is a weird combination of words, but it just means be happy about what you have. Be grateful for what you have. But it doesn't mean that you have to settle down. It doesn't mean that you have to deny any desire or any ambition. Be happy with what you have, but know that you can have much more and work for it. And I think it's just a beautiful combination of being happy, but also motivated and ambitious, because being ambitious is not a nasty word. It doesn't mean that somebody is greedy. If you can appreciate what you have, you get more of that. If you complain, then that's what you find. That's how the brain is designed. We can call it law of attraction, that you manifest it from the quantum field, or maybe it's the reticular activating system in our brain that finds the information that was around us, but because the more value we place on something, the more we are going to notice it.
Mm.
So I think we talk about exactly the same thing, but often the different concepts use different languages and they connect with different audiences. Often they stem from the exact same source. And as long as it benefits people, they use it, it makes their life better. Let's go with it.
It seems like blissfully dissatisfied is yet another way of using that other term you use, leveling up.
Pretty much, yes. There's so much negativity everywhere that nobody likes that. And then when you tell people they are not good enough or they are not there yet, then they become defensive. It's not a good feeling. And when we are in survival mode, we are not inclusive. We are not nice. We are not creative. It's not about shaming people and also companies into inclusion and things like that, but it's about understanding how we work, and then we can work on our comfort zone, on our cognitive and behavioral flexibility. That would be the goal. But it doesn't happen if we sweep everything under the rug of political correctness and we are not allowed to talk about these things. Sometimes inclusion is so overdone that in the spirit of inclusion, they exclude a lot of people and a lot of activities. Sometimes you turn into the demon that you're chasing.
Mm.
I've seen that in our field as well. And I said, no, we have to practice what we preach. Be a good example. Instead of trying to inspire millions of people globally, let's tidy up around us. Let's learn how to get along with ourselves first, and then maybe with our family, colleagues, and the people around us. We have a lot to do there.
One of the things I'm hearing from you, and please correct me if this interpretation is wrong, from just listening to all that you've said so far, is that people are resistant to conflict. But if we approach conflicting ideas from a different perspective and do it in a way so it's not overwhelming or it caused people to kick in their defense mechanism, so to speak, then we would be so much better off, which is why I like this purposeful doubt and leveling up and just looking at things from a different angle so it can be positive and a win-win for conflicting situations or uncomfortable situations.
In theory, it is correct. The world is uncertain and we need certainty. That's just human nature. We crave it. Even if it doesn't exist, we crave it. So where do we get it from? People like us. This is called homophilic diversity. We like and trust people who are similar to us, people who have common sense, people who think like us. So they agree with us. It's good. When there's a disagreement, that there is a chance that it turns out that we are wrong, that we lose, and that's not good. If I have to admit that I'm wrong, that makes the world even more uncertain, even more unpredictable. That would be the natural reaction, and I cannot have that. And you can see that in the political scenario as well. You have a lot of echo chambers, and you would think that different opinions would make yours more subtle, more nuanced. In reality, this is not what happens, because as soon as the information arrives, we dismiss it. It's dismissed upon arrival. And we also assume that the other side is against us. That's why they try to trick us. Instead of making our opinion more nuanced, it reinforces it. That's the problem with that. Because we need certainty so much. But look at the alternative to that. If you know exactly who you are and what you stand for, then you don't have to bully anyone to feel important. And you don't have to hide to feel safe. Then your self-esteem doesn't depend on how many people like you, how many people need you. This is where inclusion starts, with self-inclusion. And that's where most people are struggling. They don't know themselves. So they have to get that certainty from an external source. And if somebody attacks that external source, which can be a political party or a football team that you cheer, then it's almost like a personal attack on you. So of course you have to react, because most of your identity is based on that. But if that political party or football team is just a tiny fraction of your identity, then it's not going to trigger you that much.
My thanks to Java Tolt. If you'd like to learn more about Java, go to the show notes. And if you have a question or comment, go to unlabeledleadership.com, click the message icon, and leave a voicemail message for up to 1 minute. I'd like to thank those who donate to the show. Your contributions makes a difference because this is an all-volunteer service. I'd like to thank you for listening. This is Gary DePaul. Until next time, lead on.